content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. The next half hour, I'm going to be reading articles from the Harvard Health Letter, the Harvard Heart Letter, and maybe from the Mayo Clinic newsletter. I'm going to turn first to the Harvard Heart Letter, to an article from the November 2022 issue entitled Decoding the Price of Heart Tests and Procedures. A Harvard study found stunning price variations for common tests across top-ranked hospitals. Before you shell out money for a service like a home repair or a plane ticket, chances are you shop around to find the best price. You can't do that for medical services because of the way our healthcare system works. You don't even know how much your health insurer will pay and how much will be your responsibility until the bill arrives. The new federal Transparency in Coverage rule, which took effect in January of 2021, aims to address this problem. Issued by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the rule requires hospitals to make the prices for every item and service they provide available to the public and create a consumer-friendly tool to enable patients to look up their projected costs for common tests and procedures. Because cardiovascular disease is the most expensive chronic disease for America's healthcare system, clarifying the actual costs associated with diagnosis and treatment makes sense. To that end, researchers at the Richard A. and Susan F. Smith Center for Outcomes Research at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center took advantage of data made available under the new transparency rule. By searching the websites of 20 top-rated hospitals in the United States, they were able to compare the prices for 6 common heart tests and procedures. These prices are the results of negotiations between an insurance company and a hospital or health system. Their findings, published in September in JAMA Internal Medicine, revealed wide price variations. The variation in price for identical cardiovascular tests and procedures across different hospitals was quite frankly stunning, said senior author Dr. Rishi Wadera. Across the hospitals, there was a tenfold difference in the median price of an echocardiogram or heart ultrasound. Price differences were even greater for procedures like implanting a pacemaker or a percutaneous coronary intervention, a category that includes minimally invasive procedures to open clogged heart arteries, like placing a stent. Just as striking were the large price differences within a given hospital, depending on which commercial insurance company a patient had. In one hospital, the price of a stress test varied fivefold. It's hard to argue that these prices reflect differences in the quality of care, given that the team looked at top-rated hospitals from the annual ranking in the U.S. News and World Report, Dr. Wadera points out. Instead, the prices likely reflect which stakeholder, the hospital or insurance company, has the stronger negotiating power in the boardroom. For both entities, factors like location, size, and popularity influence that power dynamic, which in turn affects the market dynamic that dictates costs. One argument for the transparency rule was to give insurance companies more negotiating power to lower prices demanded by hospitals, says Dr. Andrew Osaran, the study's lead author. Another was to empower consumers and catalyze competition. But for now, accessing the cost data isn't easy, and about 20% of hospitals they studied didn't provide any price information. For those that did, the information was very challenging to navigate and interpret. Patients never see the payer-negotiated prices that hospitals and insurance companies agree upon. What you actually end up paying is, of course, heavily influenced by the specifics of your insurance, including copays and deductibles. When insurance companies have to pay hospitals high prices, those costs trickle down to patients in some shape or form, says Dr. Wadera. The ultimate goal of our work is to better understand the extent to which high prices are driving the more than $350 billion spent on cardiovascular disease every year, and find ways to reduce it, said Dr. Osaran. For now, the quality of the data limits the type of questions we can answer. But researchers and policymakers are paying more attention to this topic, he says. We're optimistic that over time, high-quality price data will be easily accessible, allowing us to tackle some of these important policy issues. Well, now we're going to turn to the Harvard Health Letter, and I'm going to start by reading some news briefs. The first one, which is very interesting to a lot of people, over-the-counter hearing aids are finally available. If you have difficulty hearing and you've been putting off doing anything about it, this is a good time to take action. In August of this year, the FDA finally approved a new category of safe, regulated hearing aids sold over-the-counter. You can get them without a prescription for thousands of dollars less than traditional prescription hearing aids, which can cost $5,000 or more per pair. The move is meant to make hearing aids more widely available to people who otherwise couldn't afford them, or who can't get to a doctor or an audiologist for a hearing evaluation. Instead, you can simply order over-the-counter hearing aids online, or buy them at a store or pharmacy. They are self-fitting, which means that you'll adjust them yourself. The devices are meant only for people who perceive mild to moderate hearing loss, who need to amplify the volume of sounds around them. If you're not sure how serious your hearing loss is, it's a good idea to get an evaluation from an audiologist. Since getting the right fit and effectiveness takes trial and error, you might also want to consult an audiologist for advice on the right over-the-counter hearing aid for you. The second article in news briefs, drinking black tea is linked to longevity. Break out the teacups. It may be time for a toast to black tea, one of the most popular beverages in the world. A large study done in August found that drinking black tea was associated with longer life. This study was done in the Annals of Internal Medicine. Researchers evaluated the self-reported tea drinking habits of 500,000 middle-aged people in the United Kingdom and followed them for 11 years. Most of the participants said they regularly drank tea. 89% said they drank black tea. Compared with people who didn't drink black tea, those who had two or more cups of black tea per day had a 9 to 13% lower risk of premature death, including lower rates of death from cardiovascular disease or stroke. The results weren't affected if tea drinkers added milk or sugar. if the tea was warm, hot, or very hot, or if the tea drinkers also drank coffee, or if tea drinkers were extremely sensitive to caffeine. The study was observational and therefore cannot prove that drinking black tea caused people to live longer. But we do know that black tea is rich in plant chemicals called phytochemicals, especially theaflavones, which are associated with health benefits. Now I'm going to turn to another article in the Harvard Health Letter, and this one is called Six Myths About Dementia. Learn the facts so you can be proactive about your cognitive health. Dementia is so widely discussed that you might feel you know a bit about it, but there are many misconceptions about the condition, and believing them could potentially affect your health. For the real story on six common myths about dementia, we turn to Dr. Andrew Budson, Chief of Cognitive and Behavioral Neurology at the Veterans Affairs Boston Healthcare System, lecturer in neurology at Harvard Medical School, and co-author or editor of 8 books about memory loss. Myth number one, dementia is a disease. And Dr. Budson says, dementia is not a disease. It's a general term to describe thinking and memory skills that have deteriorated to the point that you experience problems with daily activities. A number of conditions can cause dementia. Alzheimer's disease is the most common, but there are other types of dementia, including vascular dementia due to strokes, primary progressive aphasia, frontotemporal dementia, and Lewy body dementia. Myth number two is memory loss is the first sign of dementia. And Dr. Budson says, memory loss is generally the first sign of Alzheimer's disease, but not always. A 2021 study found that Alzheimer's disease often showed up as word-finding difficulty, trouble seeing clearly, not explained by eye issues, or trouble balancing your checkbook. Initial symptoms of other types of dementia can vary. For example, primary progressive aphasia starts with language problems, and dementia with Lewy bodies can start with visual hallucinations of little people or animals. By the way, Lewy bodies is spelled capital L-E-W-Y. The third myth, dementia is a natural part of aging. And Dr. Budson says, dementia is not part of the normal aging process. It is simply more common as people get older, just like heart disease, stroke, and cancer. Research published in 2022 from scientists who studied the U.S. adult population found that about 41% of dementia risk might be preventable. In this study, the most important way to reduce your risk of dementia was to treat your blood pressure, control your weight, and engage in regular physical activity. Myth number four, dementia is always genetic. And Dr. Budson says, dementia is not always genetic. We think dementia is probably genetic about half the time. We don't have solid evidence. We do know that some people in South America carry rare genes that almost guarantee a 100% likelihood of developing young-onset Alzheimer's disease between ages 35 and 65. For the rest of us, having a family history of dementia makes it 2 to 4 times more likely. And there is a common genetic variant that about 25% of the population has, called the APOE4 allele. E4 allele for short. Allele is spelled A-L-L-E-L-E. If you have that gene, your risk of developing Alzheimer's is 4 times greater. But genetics are not always destiny. Studies have shown that by engaging in good lifestyle behaviors, like eating a Mediterranean diet and doing aerobic exercise that strengthens your heart and lungs, you can reduce your risk of developing Alzheimer's, even if you have the E4 allele. Myth number 5, dementia causes loss of all memories. And Dr. Budson says, Alzheimer's disease does cause a loss of memories, but generally not all memories, at least not until the end of life. People with Alzheimer's begin having trouble remembering what happened recently, in the prior hours, days, weeks, or months. Things that happened years ago from childhood through age 35 or so are generally remembered. This is because the hippocampus, one part of the brain that is damaged in Alzheimer's, oversees recent memories, not older memories. Other types of dementia might not cause memory loss at all. And finally, myth number 6, dementia-like symptoms are never reversible. And Dr. Budson says, memory loss and other problems with thinking aren't always caused by Alzheimer's or another type of dementia. Sometimes there's another cause, like depression, or another psychiatric disorder, or a medication side effect, or use of alcohol or cannabis, or thyroid disease or another medical disorder, or a vitamin deficiency. In many ways, treating the condition may reverse the dementia-like symptoms. So if you're having problems with thinking and memory, see your doctor to find out if the issues can be treated or even eliminated. And now we're going to return to another interesting section. And this is called Ask the Doctor. And it's by Dr. Anthony L. Komaroff, who is the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Health Letter. And there's a question. I'm 70, and my memory isn't what it used to be. I've been seeing news about procedures to improve memory, like injecting young blood or stimulating the brain with electrical currents. Is any of this true? And Dr. Komaroff responds, believe it or not, it could be, but don't hold your breath waiting for this research to produce a treatment that helps you and me. What you see in the news is part of a growing body of research on slowing aging. We've talked about this before. We used to assume that aging, like death, was inevitable, but increasing evidence indicates that it may become possible someday to slow, if not eliminate, the aging process. That's even true of the aging brain. Between the ages of 50 and 60, various aspects of thinking begin to wane. A little less than 10 years ago, experiments showed that when blood of young mice was introduced into old mice, memory improved in the old mice. And a study published online May 11th of 2022 by the prestigious scientific journal Nature showed that when spinal fluid from young mice was infused into the brains of old mice, this also improved memory. More important, these studies have identified specific molecules in the blood and spinal fluid that appear responsible for the improved memory, knowledge that might someday lead to medicines that can prevent or reverse memory loss. For several decades, scientists have also been trying to improve memory by exposing the brain to electrical currents, with very mixed results. The studies have focused on both working memory and long-term memory. Working memory is temporarily stored in one part of our brain when we experience an event, and is then transferred to another part of the brain for long-term storage. In contrast to past mixed results, a study in humans published online August 22, 2022, by the journal Nature Neuroscience, reported on specific types of electrical stimulation directed at specific areas of the brain. The stimulation lasted for 20 minutes each day for 4 days, and it improved both working memory and long-term memory for at least a month. The electrical stimulation involved no surgery and no pain. These encouraging results need to be reproduced by other scientists studying other people before they can be considered true. If they are confirmed, it will remain to be determined how long the benefits last and whether there are any adverse effects. So like I said, don't hold your breath. But I think that science is finally beginning to understand the aging process well enough to offer the hope that we will someday be able to slow it, even the effects of aging on the brain. Now, again from the Harvard Heart Letter, comes an article called The Best Exercises for Your Warm-Up. Tailor a warm-up to the type of physical activity you'll be doing. A warm-up is essential before a workout. Sometimes just marching in place and moving your arms around for a few minutes is enough to prepare your body for what it's about to endure. At other times, it takes more work to get your body ready. Many people think a warm-up before playing golf, pickleball, or tennis means taking a couple of practice swings. In reality, it should include 5 to 10 minutes of warm-up activity, says Christine Ruggeri, a physical therapist specializing in sports medicine at Harvard-affiliated Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital. What does the warm-up do? Warm-up activities accomplish several tasks. They get blood pumping, which sends oxygen and energy to your tissues and muscles, so they're ready for activity. It puts muscles and joints through their range of motion, gently stretching them so they can accommodate broad movements. And it prepares the joints for forward and backward movement, side-to-side movement, and rotation. The type of warm-up you need depends on your activity. For a strengthening routine or moderate intensity activity like brisk walking or riding a bike, marching in place for a few minutes makes an effective warm-up. Swing your arms as you march. Alternating leg activity can quickly raise the heart rate, which is important in a warm-up. Marching also works your leg and buttock muscles. The leg you lift works the hip flexor. Your stationary leg works the gluteal muscles in the buttocks and the quadriceps. For more intense activity. For vigorous physical activity like swimming or playing tennis, or for activity involving strenuous physical movements like golf, you'll need a more extensive warm-up. For example, golf requires that you swing your arms and turn your trunk. Tennis and pickleball require these movements, as well as lateral shuffles, so you'll want to prepare the muscles for that. One way to warm up is to practice moves you'll perform later. Do the movement repeatedly in a slow and controlled manner to allow the body to adjust to the activity, Ruggeri says. For example, for tennis, stand in place and slowly perform a backhand swing to warm up the shoulder and the core muscles. Other warm-up activities to perform before vigorous exercise include marching in place, arm sweeps, sweeping your arms overhead, torso rotations, turning your torso left and then right, and the following moves. The first one is step-ups. Facing the lowest step in the staircase, take one full step up and step back down. Repeat the exercise 10 times, take a break, then do another 10. This targets your quadricep muscles when you step up and your gluteal muscles when you step down. When you step up with one leg at a time, you also activate your core and back muscles to help keep your body upright. Next is arm circles. Put your arms out to the sides and move them in circles of varying size. Move them in forward circles for 30 seconds, then backward circles for 30 seconds. This helps the shoulder muscles and the rotator cuff, a group of muscles and tendons at the shoulder, Ruggieri says. The shoulder is the most mobile joint in the body, and these circles allow for the full range of shoulder movement. Next comes air punches. Punch the air in front of you, alternating right and left arms for 30 seconds. Then do 30 seconds of cross-body punches. Punch your right hand to the left, and then your left hand to the right. Try some uppercuts too, punching upward. Punches increase your heart rate and get more blood flowing through the arm, Ruggieri says. After the warm-up, do your workout. Finish the activity with stretches, gently holding each stress for about 30 to 60 seconds. Ruggieri recommends stretching the shoulders, the buttocks, the hip muscles, and the upper leg muscles, in other words, the hamstrings and quadriceps, as well as the calves. This will keep muscles long and supple, ready to respond the next time you call on them. And in the article, it says that the move of the month is the alternating hamstring curl. To do a hamstring curl, stand with your feet hip-width apart, bend your left knee to bring your left heel toward your buttocks as you balance on your right leg, and then return to the starting position. Repeat this with your right leg and continue the left-right sequence for a total of 10 times on each leg. Let your arms swing forward and back as you move. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I sure hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. And remember, our website is ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org.